WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today and tomorrow, we'll be looking at the presidential campaign from the perspectives of two columnists who are colleagues but have very different points of view. The conservative columnist William Safire will be our guest tomorrow. With me now is Anna Quinlan. She won a Pulitzer Prize this year for her New York Times syndicated column, Public and Private. She formerly wrote a column called Life in the 30s that was about her life as a 30-something wife, mother, daughter, and journalist. Quinlan is also the author of the novel Object Lessons. I asked her what she sees as her turf in covering this presidential campaign.
I see myself a little bit as the anti-columnist. I've never worked in government. I've never covered the White House. I'm not traveling with this campaign. In fact, I've made a conscious effort to stay away from both of the major candidates. I guess I should add all three of the major candidates in the flesh, because for most of the campaign, I wanted to see this race the way that most voters are seeing it. And that's certainly not from the back of a sedan with a candidate at your side. I have a couple of interviews set up in the next couple of weeks with people who are higher up in the campaigns. I'm going to be talking to Hillary Clinton next week because I want very much to write a column about what her role should be if, in fact, her husband is elected president. But I've tried to stay away from the camps and spent much more time watching the debates, for example, on television, just like so many other people have done, looking at the commercials, reading the papers, and being a citizen columnist, I guess is the best way to put it.
As Anna Quinlan, citizen, what are some of the issues that affect you and your family most directly in this campaign?
Well, obviously, I'm keenly interested in the economy. And quite frankly, I have no problem with Mr. Clinton's suggestion that he wants to tax people who are doing well at a higher rate, because I think that there are many, many social programs that I'm perfectly happy to fund. I'm not quite as crazy about Star Wars or some of the other permutations of the defense budget. I would hope we could do something about the public school system in this country. My children attend private schools, and quite frankly, I wish they didn't, both because of the expense and because private schools have traditionally been the great levelers. I have a 3.5-year-old daughter. I'm keenly interested in reproductive freedom, in keeping abortion safe and legal. And I'm also interested in who is going to sit on the Supreme Court that will make important decisions in the United States while my children are growing to adulthood, and that could well affect their lives. So there's a whole panoply of issues that I think are very, very important. The issue that has least surfaced in this campaign and that I find very compelling for myself and for the moral and ethical health of my kids is the poor. This has been a campaign built almost entirely around the well-being of the middle class. And while I'm well aware that the middle class has its problems, I spent the morning today at a soup kitchen in the Chelsea section of Manhattan, which I wrote an About New York column about 10 years ago when it opened. In those 10 years, I've had 3 children and gone through 3 jobs, and it never occurred to me in 1982 when I visited it that it would be anything but a temporary stopgap measure until government got on the ball about hunger in America. Not only has government not gotten on the ball, it seems like government isn't even interested in the game. And I would hope that whichever of these candidates wins, they would turn our attention back to people who are not having trouble making ends meet, but haven't had ends meeting for years and are going to bed every night with their stomachs empty.
If you were one of the journalists on one of the 2 debates with journalists asking the questions, do you know what questions you would have asked?
Yes, I would have asked about abortion. I would have asked about the genesis and the development of each of the candidates' positions on abortion, because while I think Mr. Perot either has been consistently the same or has not had to publicly declare his position until it was already fully formulated, both Governor Clinton and President Bush have changed somewhat on some of their attitudes. The president, of course, once was pro-choice, is now determinedly anti-choice, at least in his public posture. And Governor Clinton has been an advocate of some of the limitations upon legal abortion that those people who think abortion should be legal and untrammeled have not agreed with, most specifically parental notification. So I would have liked to have asked when they first began to think about the issue, how their opinions changed about the issue over the years, and what limitations they think should be put upon abortion if they think it should in fact be legal.
Before you wrote your current column, Public and Private, you wrote a column called Life in the 30s, which was a very personal column, and you'd write a lot about your family in it. You have three children now, so, I mean, obviously, you know, family issues are very important to you. How did you feel at around the time of the Republican Convention when, you know, the issue of traditional family values was being discussed so much?
Well, I was totally disgusted by it because of the families that they seem to be representing or not the families that I know. I mean, the idea that anyone in 1992 would still think that a family consists of a mother, a father, and two little kids all living in a house together and doing well is painfully naive. And I also thought that family values was a not very subtle cover for example, opposing equality for gay people in this country, opposing gay families, saying that if you became pregnant accidentally and decided to keep and raise a child on your own, that somehow you were less equal than a family that had a married mom and dad. So that while family values in the abstract sounds like a wonderful thing, and in fact, I'm constantly working on our family values. I thought it was code in this case for an exclusionary policy rather than an inclusionary one. Finally, I thought I saw a lot of family values today at this soup kitchen, but they were the values of giving and sharing and taking people in and offering them warmth on a very cold day. So that I don't like to limit my family values by blood. I really wished this morning, quite frankly, that my kids could have been with me and that they could have spent some time talking to the men and women I was talking to who are down on their luck but remarkably optimistic nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. The whole idea of traditional family values got very played up at about the time of the Republican convention. Then when that didn't seem to go over that big, the subject got played down.
Right.
What do you think that says? Do you think that it says that approach to family values won't play nationally in this country? Or do you think that that's going to surface again soon?
I think that it says that the American people are not stupid and that they understood what the subliminal message was to the family values approach and that they saw it not so subliminally when Pat Buchanan stood up and gave his absolutely hateful opening night speech in which he effectively disenfranchised about two-thirds of the American populace. You know, out there are many ordinary, traditional people who have found out over the years that their sons and daughters are gay. And out there are many ordinary, traditional people who have had to cope with their own or their children's splintered marriages and with babies who came along at a time when they weren't necessarily expected and with relationships that perhaps didn't exist or were hidden 50 years ago. Those people in their own lives have learned to roll with those punches, and I don't think they liked it one bit when one of the standard bearers of the Republican Party stood up and started to jettison their children and their grandchildren before their eyes.
What do you want to know about the candidates' families? How relevant is it to you whether the candidates have had affairs or not, and how many children they have, and how close they are to their children?
Well, I think you learn something about a man by learning that. I think if a man is not close to his kids and he has regrets about that, you know something about the way in which he's grown and developed as a person. If he is close to his children, I think that says some very good things about him. In terms of their marriages, I like to know that men treat their wives with respect and that they see them as full partners and sentient human beings. I was very disappointed at the debate, for example, that when Susan Rook of CNN quite properly raised the question of why the inner circles of all three of these men are inhabited almost exclusively by white guys, that Governor Clinton did not say, one of my two or three closest advisors is female and she happens to be my wife. I'm sure he felt that he couldn't say that because of the heat that Hillary's taken. But given her resume and given her intelligence and her achievements, I find it very disappointing that in America he didn't feel free to say that. And I found it very dispiriting that Ross Perot still thinks the answer to a question about full equality for women in our society is to cite his four beautiful daughters. I'm real pleased that he has a nice family, but that doesn't answer the question about why he doesn't have a woman in his inner circle to advise him on policy.
Do you think Hillary Clinton has begun to reemerge? She seemed to be kept hidden away for a while.
She better reemerge. I mean, here's a woman who, if Bill Bradley was elected president, would certainly be on any short list for, if not a cabinet-level position, at least a sub-cabinet-level position. If this country uses that woman to cut ribbons for the next 4 years, if her husband is elected president, it will be a real shame, and it'll show how little we've advanced in terms of the treatment of women.
John Kennedy appointed his brother Robert Kennedy to be Attorney General. If Bill Clinton appointed Hillary in a top-level position, do you think that that would be accepted?
I think that the scream that you'd hear would be heard round the world.
Do you think it would be inappropriate?
Yes, I suppose I do think it would be inappropriate, much as I think that she is qualified for almost any high-level position in government. I think it was inappropriate when Bobby Kennedy was appointed. Mm-hmm. In fact, Clark Clifford tells this wonderful story about going to Joe Kennedy to try to tell him that this is a terrible idea, and the Kennedy patriarch sitting there nodding his head, and then at the end saying, Clark, I just want to tell you one thing. Bobby Kennedy is going to be the Attorney General of the United States. I think that it's better not to appoint family members to high positions in your administration. However, if they are talented and accomplished and well-informed, I think seeking their counsel constantly and letting them use those skills in an unpaid and unappointed position is most important.
I'm wondering if during the conventions when all the candidates had their families, you know, up at the podium, if your children were judging the candidates by what their kids look like, and if they look like the kind of kids that they'd be friends with.
No, but my kids have been very judgmental about the candidates. I actually watched the vice presidential debate with my eldest, who is 9 years old, because he had the assignment to watch it and write about it. And he was very critical of all three of them, even though he has strong opinions about who he thinks should be president. He said that Al Gore acted like America, like he was the teacher and America was the kids. He said all Dan Quayle could say is Bill Clinton can't tell the truth, and what about all the poor people in the country? And he said that Ross Perot picked the wrong person to be vice president. He wrote that in his essay. So he's been quite critical of the candidates, but he hasn't said anything about their kids. I'm not sure that he gets a sense of how public children become under those circumstances, because although I have a very public job, my kids have a very private life, which has been real important to me, not to have them exposed to too much of the heat or the flack or even the adulation that sometimes comes with being a New York Times columnist.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Anna Quinlan, columnist for the New York Times, and we're talking about the presidential campaign. She also has a novel called Object Lessons that recently came out in paperback. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is New York Times columnist Anna Quinlan, and I should mention that tomorrow we'll be joined by her colleague William Sapphire, who is also a columnist for the New York Times and writes from a much more conservative point of view.
The excellent conservative columnist, Bill Sapphire.
Yeah.
I actually greatly admire him. I mean, no one can work a telephone the way Bill Sapphire can.
Yeah, what have you learned by watching him work a telephone?
That reporting is a critical part of writing an opinion column, and that the very best opinion columns are written not by people who lean back in their chair and think deep thoughts, but by people who call everyone they can get their hands on and say, what do you think about that?
So do you do that ever?
Yeah, sure.
Who do you call?
That's why I went to that soup kitchen today.
Uh-huh.
Well, with me, it's more being out on the street, because There are people who would write a column about the economy by talking to Felix Rohatyn or Alan Greenspan, and I certainly pay close attention to the pronouncements of those wise men. But for me, more of the economy is contained in the astronomical numbers of people who are being fed for free at places like the place I visited today than in looking at the economic indicators.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about why this campaign has seemed to become a national drama in a way that campaigns of the recent past have not?
Well, first of all, because we feel like we're in real trouble.
Mm-hmm.
The ship of state sailed on and on, and sometimes we were interested in its course, and sometimes we didn't think that its course had much to do with us. But right now it has a hole in the bottom, and the water is coming in, and all of us have been bailing for 4 years, whether because we were in danger of losing our homes or because our kids couldn't afford to go to college or couldn't afford to go to the college of their choice, or because we'd gotten pink slipped. And so I think that the reason that people are most keenly interested is because there's a sense that we need some sort of a change in direction, a new course. But it's also been a race in which every conceivable issue has been played out. I mean, we've gone over and over the question of how much character matters, of how much marital fidelity matters, of whether drug use matters, of whether military service matters.
Yeah, and in that respect, I think that this campaign has been more like a novel than your average campaign.
It has.
Because the characters keep getting more and more complicated and developed.
But I've got to tell you, too, I think it's been very useful, because certain of those issues, I think, have been put to rest for all time.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the drug issue. I don't think that's ever going to be a real issue in a campaign again.
Yeah, what happens, though, if they bring up that somebody did LSD the next time, or cocaine or something, as opposed to, like, inhaling?
I'm still not sure that it's going to track real well. Because, of course, the other thing that you've seen in this race is this generational split.
Yeah, well, I wonder how you feel. This is the campaign in which a presidential candidate is closer to your generation than any other presidential candidate has been. Has that affected your involvement with the campaign in any way?
Well, certainly I've understood so much of what he's been saying. I mean, when the president says that he just doesn't get the anti-war activities, I not only get them, but to some small extent, I was involved with them. And I've certainly understood a lot of the Sturm und Drang about Hillary Clinton, because she's had to make so many of the choices that I've had to make and that my friends have had to make. And the marijuana controversy, I mean, I remember very well writing a column when I was writing Life in the 30s that began. I remember the first time I smoked marijuana. It was the closest I ever thought I was going to come to losing my job. And, of course, that was because I was underestimating the men who run the paper. So that a lot of this has seemed terribly real to me, but in some sense terribly unimportant, because I'm part of a whole group of people who passed through those things and then went on to something else. And so the idea that there was somehow something indelible about them, I think, seemed unrealistic to us.
Usually election time is a time when a lot of people get angry at the media for one reason or another.
Right.
And we have President Bush saying now, don't listen to some crackpot who comes on after the debate and tells you what to think. What do you think of the way the candidates have been portraying the press?
I think the press has done a really good job in this election. I think that most newspapers and television networks know that they did not handle the 1988 campaign as well as it could have been handled, that they did not dig enough in terms of claims made by both sides, that the coverage was too driven by spin doctors and not enough by skeptical reporting, and that what you're seeing in 1992 is a reaction to that. I think we've covered the waterfront on this one in a way that I've been very, very pleased by. And I think that any discussion of the relationship between the press and the people that suggests that the people sit there and let us spoon-feed them our biases and conclusions is completely flawed and totally underestimates the American people. The president should know well, if he's talked to even a dozen Americans, that this is not a country where people sit there and watch Robin McNeil and say, I'm going to go right down the line with everything that he's just said, or Gergen and Shields, or Jeff Greenfield on ABC. The fact of the matter is, because of cable, because of the way we're covering this election, because of C-SPAN, we are now in a position to get more information than ever before. And I think the American voter is sucking up all that stuff, turning it over in his mind, and then saying, okay, this is what I'm going to do.
Anna Quinlan, I want to thank you very much for talking with
us. You're welcome.
Anna Quinlan is a columnist for the New York Times and author of the novel Object Lessons. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, a more conservative perspective on the elections from Quinlan's colleague at the Times, William Sapphire. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.